Radioland USA Today. So when I asked Phyllis what she would like for you to know, for all of you to know about her today, she said, just tell them that I'm going to ask them to help me create a cultural revolution in this country on the side of civility and higher level of expectation regarding personal accountability at levels of American business. Tell them I believe that our entire, yes, our entire system of free enterprise is at stake, and so is our global reputation, that's a big thing now, as a nation, and that together we can change the world. So ladies and gentlemen, please help me welcome Phyllis Davis.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, it's such a pleasure to be here today. I really want to thank you for inviting me. But before I start, I want to find out if you call yourself the Los Angeles County Human Resources Managers Committee or the County of Los Angeles Person Directors Committee. You guys seem to have quite of an internal battle finding out who you are and re-identifying yourselves in this, in these changing times, do you not? I like that. I was really hoping Mike Henry was going to be here today so that I could thank him personally. So if maybe he'll slip in, I'll get to do that. But Elaine, I'd like to thank you, and I'm going to hopefully pronounce your name correctly. I've been rehearsing it in the back of the room. Paleologus. Oh, I did. Oh, thank you very much. Beautiful Greek name. Thank you for having me come today. You know, I was thinking as I was driving over here today that you really are the key leaders of this community. And it's really with you and you only that we really can help change the culture of not only Southern California, but the world. Because you are in a position of influence in your communities and really create a message of higher ethical standards in the world. Why not Southern California to begin that as a message? Those of you that are in human resource, whether you're a public defender or you're working in social services, you know, you have an awesome responsibility, and I really applaud you and want to thank you for that, you know, to help bring jobs to the community, to help find housing in the community, to educate people so they can help themselves, to help families, all the and animals, too, I love that, all the things that you do to make Los Angeles the greatest city in the world. I live in Los Angeles County, and I just am so grateful to stand before you today, because it's a topic that means a lot to me, and if I can bring it to my city, what a marvelous thing that I've done to be able to help my community. So it's a great honor, and I'm humbled to be here. I'm really here today to talk to you about a topic that's certainly near and dear to my heart, and that is the topic of ethics in American business today. Since the fall of Enron in 2000, we've all heard a lot about ethics in the news, have we not? And we've been challenged to look at it and to think about it in our own departments, in our own companies, in our own communities. You know, I don't know if you've ever heard the expression, it's not personal, it's just business. I'm here today to tell you it's very personal. Business has gotten very personal. And before the fall of Enron, you know, it seems like that we seem to even be naive about the fact that we believed that there were trusted leaders at the top of our companies that were really going to guide us and that our organizations were safe. And we've had the longest run of economic growth in this nation's history. And because of that long-term economic growth, we really have created a technological wonder in this country that's changed the world. You know, it's interesting, at a recent gathering in March of 2003 of this year, 120 executives gathered in Charlotte, North Carolina, to talk about ethics in the world and corporate values and how they were catalysts for positive change in our communities and our organizations. And Warren Buffett was the keynote speaker. And he was so great. And he said, it's interesting today that the CEOs of top of organizations and companies today have about as much respect as used car salesmen. It's not too good, is it? Again, I look back and I think how trusting we were to believe that people that were in positions of leadership really were going to guide and protect the people in their organizations and companies. Actually, people who make a mistake, we realize they have feet of clay. You know, this nation was based on Puritan principles. We like to forgive. We really enjoy having people come to us and say, you know what, I made a mistake. But in this age of spin doctors and powerful attorneys that try and change situations to make it look like companies aren't guilty, that's really sort of what got us in this position today, and it's, you know, really why I'm really in front of you today. But those of us that really have trusted, and I certainly, you know, there's not a day passes, I don't think, of the people that that really fell hard in the Enron scandal that had the retirements in Enron stock. And the other companies that have disappointed their stockholders, stakeholders, consumers, and customers. The people that are in positions today that we entrust with billions, that's B, billions with a B of our dollars, you know, the fact that there's a lack of trust, you know, Congress and President Bush stepped forward and created the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, which I'm sure that all of you that are in HR certainly know about right now. It's far from perfect, and I know that, and you know that, and all of us know that, but and it maybe was a rush to judgment on the act of Congress to create something that would create some attention to corporate responsibility, and I'm grateful for that. You know, and it's we really need to do what we can to regain trust. And there's been an extension. In May, they extended compliance for the Sarbanes-Oxley Act to June 15th of 2004, and for smaller companies, to April 15th of 2005, and it's really going to help people come up to compliance quicker and faster so that they can create their corporate compliance and their responsibility. So we've really come to here. We've come to realize that this fast-paced climate requires that companies create more and more profits every quarter to satisfy stockholders, stakeholders, and consumers. That's really sort of an unrealistic expectation today. I'm not suggesting that America's glory days are over. In fact, it's just the opposite. But I think that our challenge at hand, especially in human resources and especially in positions that we can really influence communities of people, is to realize that we really have to create a zero-tolerance policy, ladies and gentlemen, for anyone who does not honor the ethics policies in place in organizations. It's far more than knowing what's right and wrong and staying out of trouble. Ethics is a golden opportunity for organizations and communities to create loyalty among their consumers and customers. I still believe in the American dream. I saw it in your lobby outside. Los Angeles ownership, home ownership, the American dream. Yes, it is. And ethics is a way to create that within organizations and communities. You may have heard the story of Jason Blair, the young journalist who resigned on May 1st from the New York Times. He was charged with finding 36 instances of inaccuracies and plagiarism in 73 articles he wrote for the New York Times. He resigned on the 1st of May. And it created quite a flutter among journalists. And the question became, is the New York Times the reputable source? Can we still trust them? And the New York Times did some brilliant things. They did some brilliant things, and I really applaud them for this. First of all, the two senior editors, Raines and Boyd, stepped down amidst the scandal because the plagiarism and the inaccuracies happened on their watch. And they felt a sense of responsibility, although they were not asked to resign. They stepped forward and offered their resignations in light of the issues that it was creating on a national basis. And the New York Times immediately went to their advertisers, and they said, okay, here's what we've done. We've, Jason Blair is gone, the young journalist. Raines and Boyd have stepped down, and we've accepted their resignations. We've really rooted out this problem, and furthermore, we're going to find out our hiring practices. We're going to re-examine that as an issue, and we're going to also re-examine our newsroom practices and look into some of our sources and our bylines, and we're going to get to the problem of this, and this is never going to happen again. Are you okay with that? 95% of them said yes. Now, this news all broke on a Friday, and the stock on that Friday was at $46.35 a share. At Monday, it closed up at $46.67 a share. Now, that's taking care of the problem. That's not with the use of attorneys and spin doctors. That's taking care of the problem, and I applaud the New York Times for having done that. Another good example of ethical practices was when Johnson & Johnson, some of you may remember this story, in 1982, taking Tylenol Extra Strength tablets off the market. The CEO, James Burke was the CEO of Johnson & Johnson during that time, he took the tablets off the market when he was on an airplane. He consulted people and his advisors while he was in the air about what to do and took off 31 million bottles of Tylenol caplets from all the stores across America. That was $100 million worth of product, of all Tylenol products. He also stopped production on those Tylenol products until they could find out what the problem was. Now, the story is that James Burke did this because the credo of Robert Johnson, who was the founder of Johnson & Johnson, saw business as an opportunity and a responsibility to society going beyond sales and profit. In other words, he believed that his customers' health came before profit margins. Now, that to me is a perfect model for corporate ethics. Ethics is certainly in the news. I mean, just in the last 24 hours, the Attorney General for the state of Oklahoma filed charges against Bernie Ebbers, who is the former CEO of WorldCom MCI, along with five other WorldCom employees. See, initially, WorldCom reported a $4 billion irregularity in their accounting. But as they began to research the $4 million discrepancies, they found out that it was actually $11 billion discrepancy. And it's really frightening to think that the problems have continued to grow as a result of those discrepancies. I want to read you a quote that was in the paper this morning that's from the Attorney General of Oklahoma. He said, "We allege that the company and these six employees executed a scheme to artificially inflate the value of WorldCom stock and bonds by intentionally falsifying information filed with the SEC. WorldCom's actions cost Oklahoma's state pension funds about $64 million, and I'm certain that there would be private investors in the state of Oklahoma whose cumulative loss may even dwarf the pension fund loss to the state of Oklahoma." Now, here's a punchline. Other states are considering lawsuits against WorldCom now as well. You see, shareholders have an opinion. Finally, shareholders and stockholders are rising up and saying, if you don't lead us and if you're not honest about where you're leading us, we do have repercussions. We live in interesting times, do we not? We're seeing evidence every single day that demonstrates that the principles that our parents and our grandparents taught us, that lying and cheating and stealing and fraud are bad for us. They're bad for business. They're bad for the soul of our nation. There are actually some schools of thought right now that are saying that ethics can't be taught beyond the age of 21. That if we didn't learn civility and morality at the knee of our parents or grandparents or caregiver, that it can't be learned past the age of 21. Under university policies right now, ethics has never really been valued as anything other than philosophy. It hasn't been valued as a science that could be considered a business course. You know, MBA programs are cranking out a lot of brilliant minds. Certainly we've seen that Jeffrey Skilling, who was the former CEO of Enron, graduated from Harvard with an MBA, and Andrew Fastow, who's now in prison, he received an MBA from Kellogg School of Management in Chicago. Didn't do much to help them. So what can we do? What can you do? Well, we all know there's a problem, right? We can agree that there's all a problem. So what can we do? And that's the reason you came here today, other than to be part of your meeting, to come here and find out what you can do today to help create ethic-centric City of Los Angeles. And I've created six solutions for you today that I really created for you, and I mean that seriously. So let's just start at the beginning so that I can give you some ideas that I believe might be helpful. And number one, before an organization, before a city, before a country, before a nation, before even a family can begin to establish itself as an ethic-centric based organization, the first thing they've got to always do is agree that there's work to be done and that things can be done to improve. And that's really the first thing on my list today, is to adopt a high level of humility. As much as any organization wants to believe that they're doing everything they can do to bring a high level of ethics in their business dealings, they need to realize that corporate America in the 21st century is really littered with examples of what not to do today. The days come that ethical infractions in organizations and companies are not permissible. We need to realize that companies are built at the top level of executives and that they die at the top level of executives. And that really means you. And that means your constituents and your organizations and the people that you hire and put in places that influence policy. It's time that organizational leaders come together, as you've done today, and agree that an ethic-centric culture is important. And really only now, especially since Sarbanes-Oxley, have companies and organizations come together and said, you know, we really realize that it's time to do something to help create safe, productive workplaces that are, dare I say, even enjoyable for people to come to work. To deliver high levels of trust to consumers, clients, customers, and constituents. What does it take for an organization to become ethical besides a dose of humility? Well, it really takes organizations' top leaderships to agree, this is important, to build and sustain ethic-centric organization is going to take time, it's going to take responsibility, and it's going to take resources to train your people, because building a successful ethics-based organization is not a short-term value. It's going to take a long time to roll it out. In fact, it's a never-ending process. It's not something that we can just have a discussion about and you can create a document and it's going to make changes. It's an effort that never ends, and that, my friends, is personal accountability. Number two, I suggest an experiment that is grounded in business practices that help build this great nation. My brother's with me today. We're from the Southwest. We're seventh generation Oklahoma Choctaw Indian. And the great businesses that were built in the Southwest in the early days before Oklahoma was even a state, people did handshake deals. They got together and they did what I'm going to call brown bag lunches. They didn't call it that then, but that's what they were. They were when people that trusted each other came together and they sat down and they closed the door and they said, what works and what doesn't work? How can we fix what doesn't work? How can we barn raise? How can we build? How can we move out into the community and create jobs and housing and educate people and protect families? How can we do what it is that you are doing for the County of Los Angeles? People shared small meals and they talked to discuss problems. They talked openly. I recommend you try a brown bag lunch in your office. I want you to invite everyone to leave their laptops, their cell phones, their beepers, and their technology outside the door. I want you to invite people in, sit down, pull out your tuna fish sandwich, put your orange on the table, look at each other across the table and say, okay, what works, what doesn't work? Companies have been afraid to do this until now. They've been terrified that some ethical dilemma would come flying out of the corporate closet. But you know, if you don't do that, that's exactly what's going to happen. Unless you begin honest, open discussions about the things that are going on, you can expect your problems to grow and glow in the dark like a fungus, because that's what'll happen. I'm encouraging you to try some very non-technology suggestion with this, to invite the people in your department and find out what works, what doesn't. I was invited to a large company recently, and 380 people came to hear me speak. And a young woman stood up in the back of the room and she said, you know, I've got office politics that are going on in my office, and the productivity is down, and there's backstabbing, and there's gossip, and things aren't getting done, and the well's being poisoned, and I don't know what to do. And she was in tears. That's an ethical dilemma. If there's a missing link in the chain, and it's causing the workplace not to be a safe and productive workplace where it's enjoyable, so you can retain your top talent in the office and they don't run away, then you've got a problem on your hands. How do you deal with that? Because you see, talent is not enough today. People are being hired for educations and technical skills, but if they don't have the chemistry and the high degree of workability where they can get along with people and make it a safe, happy, productive workplace, you've lost the battle and won the war. What difference does it make if you can't make it a happy, safe, productive workplace? So I'm asking you to close the ranks in your department and begin with a simple brown bag lunch so that you can find out what's going on. Do you know that her department manager was in that room that day and didn't know what was going on? It broke my heart. Number three, every organization needs to create a statement, just a statement that outlines what you believe to be true. A statement that outlines what you believe to be true. As most documents, it's a work in progress. I think in the old days we called them mission statements. They don't call them that anymore. We can't have a mission statement for a department, but we can try and build. You know, I loved the plaque in your lobby. You know, the American dream, home ownership. It gave me goosebumps to realize how important that is for the county of Los Angeles people to be able to be a citizen in the community and respond to the needs of their own community. So, a statement that outlines, as most documents, I want you to realize that it's the truth of the organization. Sometimes the founders of organizations and companies really created that simple statement that has actually stood the test of time. I mean, for example, Arthur Anderson, founder, promoted the idea, simple statement, think straight, talk straight. I'm wondering if they forgot that. At one time, Arthur Anderson was considered the gold standard in the profession of accounting. But during the dot-com 1980s, Arthur Anderson saw gold instead of their gold standard as being more important to them. And sadly, many of their employees, not all, because I know there were I know good people that worked for Arthur Anderson, and it's not a condemnation of them. I'm just citing the individuals who took that slippery slope and wanted to create higher and higher revenues. Something happened between the founder's belief of think straight, talk straight, and the time they became the auditors for Enron. So number two, put in writing what your leadership and your organization believes to be true, because that is personal accountability. Number four, every organization needs another little document, and that's a written document outlining the values and conduct for your employees to follow. Now, that's all well and good, but that needs to be followed by a way to teach and enforce those conducts and values. A business that has no written plan for values and conduct is bound to fail, because an organization cannot be led by the whims of personalities in that department. And you know that to be true. I mean, we've seen that in churches in this nation. when good ministers or rabbis or teachers left good churches and the churches couldn't sustain their congregation because their leader was gone. That can't happen in government. That can't happen in business. That's one of the issues that created some of the problems that we're seeing today. During the what I call the fat years, between about 1983 and 1995, the entrepreneurial leaders in the technology industry and some other industries that made great fortunes, they were very charismatic people. And they led during good times. But sadly, they didn't really have the depth of character that really could buoy up their employees during a sagging economy. And many of those same charismatic leaders didn't have the personal skills, the soft skills, if you will, to deal with the stress that they faced and began taking shortcuts to build their company back up. And I'm here to tell you that stress is the number one problem that I hear in companies when people start talking about taking shortcuts. And there are a lot of attorneys in the room. And when people do things and they don't run them through some of the legal compliance channels, it's when people get in trouble. Generally, values that are conduct that are formed through the consensus and leadership of that organization. Back to the brown bag. Companies need to find out what that consensus is. What are our values? What's the conduct? How can we measure that? What can we use to use our meager resources as a company, an organization, as a training department to roll these out? Because if you do that, what you've done is that's accountability. That's accountability. I'm finding that in companies today, when an employee is initially hired, that they are given a code of conduct, maybe even a code of ethics, and it's given to them to take home and read before they show up for work, or it's given to them on the first day. They tell them to go home and read it, and they're supposed to know what's in that information. And then when an ethical infraction comes along, when the problems arise, it's ultimately the company that has to go back and pay the price. If it's a sexual harassment lawsuit, which are very common today. It's one of the most common problems that we're seeing out there. But there are a lot of other problems. Office bullying is big right now. People that feel discriminated against for a variety of reasons. Issues that have to do with ageism and, gender discrimination. And, if you know what the rules are going in, it's a happier, safer workplace. It's sort of like a family with parents that tell children what's expected of them. It's interesting to note that the corporate code of conduct for Enron was suspended twice by their board of directors so that board directors could go out and commit conflict of interest, which I find fascinating. The Smithsonian Institute has just purchased the Enron Code of Ethics to enshrine it as a memorial to the largest scandal to date for, right? Do you love it? And in fact, I just bought a copy of the Enron Code of Ethics off eBay this week for $8.95, $14 with shipping. And I was, right? And I was hoping it would come today so I could bring it, and sadly it didn't get FedExed. I had ordered FedEx, but it didn't make it. So, but it's for sale, which I think is really, and I thought I'd frame it and put it on my office wall as a reminder that, in fact, that unless you know what the rules are, how can you follow the rules? In fact, that's what we're all faced with right now in these changing times, in a state that's having a recall election, in companies where the CEO shelf life is less than 5 years, in the problems that are facing government, in the problems that are facing business, and the problems that are facing our families, and many of them for the same reasons. Now that you've had your brown bag lunch, now that you've got a document stating what you think is true, now that you've created a code of conduct, a value, and you've figured out a way to measure that, now it's time to figure out how to roll out your plans, to teach that and educate your organization. And that's really what creates corporate cultures. you know, mergers and acquisitions are hot again in corporate America, and you know, money's sort of flowing freely again as, you know, big companies are buying up little companies, and they're merging their cultures, and you know, you've got companies that don't speak the same corporate culture language, and there's a big problem right now in helping people communicate. But corporate culture is what we also need in the county of Los Angeles. We need a culture. But you know, it's interesting. How many of you are Paul Harvey fans? Paul Harvey News. Good day, right? Well, yesterday on I'm a Paul Harvey girl. I just good Midwest values, and I still listen to Paul Harvey. And yesterday on the news, he was talking about the fact that Arnold Schwarzenegger was running for the governor of California, and he didn't find that it was odd that he should run, even though he wasn't born in this country. You ready for this? When 1 in 4 California citizens were not born in the country either. 1 in 4. You like that? Now, I don't know. I can't only back that up with what Paul Harvey said. I looked for a document on the internet last night, late at night, and I couldn't find anything to back it up. But, you know, Paul's never lied to me. So I'm just going to assume that he was telling us the truth. I thought that was really interesting. 1 out of 4 Californians were not born in this country. Isn't that interesting? Now this begs a deeper question when we really think about it. And here's the deeper question. How can we expect 150 nationalities, give or take, who come to California to blend into our business culture or our organizational culture unless we tell them what to do and what we expect of them? I mean, talent is not enough. Judgment and skills are required. And when people come from 150, give or take a few cultures, they've got a different set of judgments and values and beliefs, patterns and habits and backgrounds that are deeply ingrained in them, just as they are in me because I'm a seventh generation Oklahoman. I mean, when I came to California, I had to learn. You know, I'd never met so many vegetarians in my life when I came to California. You know, I'm a carnivore. I eat biscuits for breakfast. It was different. Of course, we're going to go out and have lunch because you and I are going to go to Mangione's and have that chopped salad. We found out we both are Mangione girls. According to a recent study done by the Southern Institute for Professional Ethics, I read this the other day, and I just love this because it so relates to what's going on with you guys right now. The number one cause for employees' unethical conduct is really a failure in organizations to really teach and educate their people what's expected of them. And that's really the problem that companies are finding, organizations are finding. How about departments? Because no one's got time with downsizing and layoffs and hearing the problems that people have that are doing 3 jobs instead of 1 that we did 10 years ago. You know, a successful organization, and this really speaks to your concerns, really knows how to educate, but you've also got to inspire people. You got to inspire people to want to make it work. You got to inspire people to really want to become personally accountability to the success of that company or department or organization. They've got to be inspired, and it's time-consuming as a manager to be able to give good feedback all the time. But if you tell people what's expected of them, they can get a lot of rewards for themselves because they feel a sense of pride and accomplishment for having done a job well done. Now, equally important along this same road is the ability to really create metrics to find out how affecting your training really is. And this really is a big mystery right now because every culture and every organization is trying to find ways to measure cost-benefit, their training dollars, their education dollars, their resources to be able to find out how they're doing. And it's really important to know that the military is just such a great example of personal accountability because every soldier is trained to hold themselves to the highest level of personal accountability. In fact, they've learned to do that for the other soldiers. They've learned to do that to protect themselves, the people that they're working with, and our nation. That's really what personal accountability is the ability to use that kind of discipline and hold yourself up. You know, personal accountability is so integral to the code of ethics and the code of conduct in the military that if there are any infractions, people are called on in front of their superiors. You were in the military, I take it. Are there military people in the room that have served in the military? I know that there are law and you know, people in the room that have legal backgrounds. It's certainly relevant to the legal issues that are going on right now. Personal accountability is what's so important right now in developing what it is that I'm asking you to do today. Number six, now it's time to take your ethics training and your ethics policies out in the world for people to see. And here's what I'm going to suggest. I'm going to suggest a town hall meeting that's led by the organization's leadership. And it certainly happens in universities around the world, and certainly happens in community-based organizations, which many of you are a part of. And it's my vision that these town hall meetings are going to become a popular trend among organizations and groups and businesses and companies to really invite consumers, customers, stakeholders, shareholders, clients, vendors. Everybody's welcome to come. I know that Oracle just had their first online town hall meeting for PeopleSoft customers last month, and they're sort of involved in some of the Sarbanes-Oxley to create a software to help control some of that. So their customers could interact with their senior executive, Vice President Chuck Phillips. See, I think that Mr. Phillips has really done a brilliant thing, because this first town hall meeting really gives people an opportunity to put a person on the other end of technology. It's been my premise for a long time that people are starving in corporate America and organizations to make a human connection. I think they're starving to talk to a real person instead of a tape-recorded message. I think they're starving from loneliness. I think people in corporate American organizations have forgotten, because of technology, what it's like to look at someone across the eye instead of sending an email. I think email is far overused. It's good for data and information, but I want to look across a table from somebody. I want to know if I believe you or not. I want to create good customer service. I got some resonance in that. Town hall meetings are a great way to solve that problem, to bring your people together so that you can get a cross-section of opinions and beliefs. You can find out what other people are thinking. In companies, I'm recommending that people go out and rent theaters in these big empty metroplexes. You know, all the theaters, the 18 and 24 seat theaters? You know, those theaters seat 400, 500, 600 people, some of the big ones. And the parking's great, and they have public restrooms and phones, and all a company has to do is to send out an announcement that the town hall meeting is going to be at your local neighborhood theater, where everyone knows, because it's on a busy street generally. And what they need to do is just give a time and a date and a place, and the theaters are inexpensive to rent, and you can even have popcorn. I like popcorn. And they can invite people in, and then they can have an agenda. Most of these town hall meetings have agendas. In fact, let me give you a suggestion for what the first town hall meeting might be for your organization. You ready? What does ethics cost? What does ethics cost? I guess that is the $64 billion question today, isn't it? What does ethics cost? It's my life's work to carry a flag across this great nation talking about that very question. And I listen to people's answers very carefully. I do my best to listen to what their cares and concerns are about the question, what does ethics cost? I've sat across the table from CEOs with non-disclosure agreements between us, and they've told me things that break my heart. I've seen them weep in front of me and say, Phyllis, what am I going to do? I sit with them and they unfold their personal and private stories in the face of a slowly, let's face it, a slowly recovering economy. Issues that have to do with time management, which we all face. Problems in office politics. Problems in hiring practices, problems in firing practices, problems that have to do with accounting. These make corporate compliance issues look like child's play, because these are human issues. These hold human hearts. This is what makes cities great. This is what makes companies great. Increased awareness is what makes ethics great. And it is the only answer, ladies and gentlemen, that's going to stop the bleeding. It's the only thing that's going to stem the tide in these troubled times. If an organization fails today, mark my words, and you heard it here first. If an organization fails today, you won't have to look too far to find out who is to blame. That is personal accountability. When you leave here today, I want you to be able to go back to your office and realize that it's you that's personal responsibility for changing the city of Los Angeles. It's you that's personal accountability to help make a difference in your department, in your community, in your family, and in the world, and in the nation. I want you to help me. So I'm going to ask you to do something very simple. I want you to repeat after me three sentences. Be willing to do that with me? Trust me enough at this point? Thank you. Stand up with me. Stand up. Ready? I am personally accountable.
I am personally accountable.
And committed to identifying. The problems in my organization. I am personally accountable. That I will help find the solutions. And implement them. I am personally accountable. And committed. They will not happen again on my watch. Now that, friends, is personal accountability. Yes. Have a seat. I'm here today to ask you to join me. To join me to help carry the message of honesty, civility, personal accountability, and fairness in the American workplace. We are a nation at war with ourselves. And in many cases, innocent people are losing their retirement. They're losing faith in their employers. They're doubting their own personal worth as human beings. And ladies and gentlemen, that must stop if we're to transform this nation. I'm asking you, I'm pleading with you to help me. Together, we can change the world. Thank you. Very kind of
you. Okay, do you have some answers?
I do. I'd love to answer some questions.
Lighter on because it's turn. And one of the things that Marilyn, maybe you could just repeat what you just told me.
Seth, if you could leave the statement that we
those
just recited with our secretary so that we...
I actually have a little present for you.
Okay.
Oh. It's for everybody in the room. I have a packet of information. Can I just do it? Just a 1 minute sales pitch? This is what I do for a living.
Thank you.
And on the back, I have the personal accountability statement, and I have my 6 points. But I'm sort of like you. I wasn't going to tell you. I was going to make you work for it.
I'll give you a...
I think people listen better if they're really listening.
Actually, I will add one more thing to it. I think we have a book for each department, so I'll be passing those out to you shortly.
And I'll autograph them. Yeah.
I have read the book.
Thank you.
Excellent.
Thanks.
And I really did enjoy it.
Thank you again for
just a really wonderful piece of writing.
Thank
and
you.
I've looked in some, just the standard Emily Post and some of the etiquette books, and it's amazing how even the etiquette books now, if you look at Miss Manners...
They're so outdated.
But they've done new ones, and they've got a lot of your concepts. They're starting to pick up all of that, what to do in the workplace and what to do in business. So
the technology changed the way we communicate. Would you agree with that? So, you know... People, we've lost our ability to know how to have any, I hate to use the word intimacy because it seems so but we don't know how to communicate anymore. So let me just give my 1 minute sales pitch and then I'll take questions. I have a ETP grant. I go into companies and train, fully funded training. We implement mentoring programs in companies, which I think is the thing of the future, is real successful mentoring. And we do all kinds of training. I've listed all 18 things we do to offer training in here. And I also am the founder and director of the American Business Ethics Connecticut Trainers Association. And if the county wants to certify some people to teach my work, you spend 2 days with me. And at the end of certification, you can go out and you can teach it. And you can make money doing it and keep all the money. I don't want your money. I just am trying to spread the message about what's going on. And believe me, this is such a hot topic that my trainers are really doing well financially, to go out and do it in community groups. And so it's nice. So on the other hand, if you want more information about any of this, or if you'd like me to come in and help you with anything, or you have a big group you want me to speak for, just let me know. Thank you for letting me do that little pitch, because it means a lot.
Okay.
Yes, please. I'd love that. Yes, thank you, Elaine.
As you heard from when we introduced ourselves, we are a public organization.
Yes.
So we're agencies that are basically out there providing various services. Earlier when we first spoke, that you mentioned that you had helped, for example, the police department. How did working with the police department?
No, I haven't. I just know that there's an ethics issue with the city.
What would you say then, in having discussed that there was two public agencies and some of the constraints that we're in? We're not in the money-making business in that.
Of course not.
But from the, at least we hope not.
Well, that's a story.
What would you say to us that are within the constraints of some of the public things? We don't have the resources. How do we
motivate
our people and get in there and really help them out?
Well, I'll be glad to put you on my email list, and you can just kind of over time learn some things if you want to give me your business card. Of course, I want to plug my book. I mean, I think there are a lot of answers in there for you, and I think that, it can help. I think it's really up to you to educate yourself about what you think is important. And I think the first thing that everybody would agree, that civility in the workplace is at an all-time low, and that departments don't cooperate. And that's what I'm finding, whether it's in a company or an organization, that it's difficult to get people to create that human connection long enough that they want to cooperate. Are you finding that true in your... It's difficult to get people to come together because of time constraints. Time management is poor right now. People are busy putting out fires. Focus is the lowest common denominator. People beg for focus, yet they allow things to happen and come in to keep them distracted all the time. I would recommend that if I could tell you anything today, it would be to really make sure that your people are held accountable, and that you need to tell them what you expect of them. And if they and when they do it, I recommend that you reward them somehow, even a cake every month. Things go a long way. Employee of the organization, I'm sure a lot of you do that right now. Some special perk that people will work for perks. I've taught classes over the years, and when I give people homework, I give them a star on their name tag. People will fight for those stars. It seems so silly, but they want to be recognized. And what is, 500 stars for $2? I mean, the things are so simple that you can reward people for their excellence, because whistleblowers are not rewarded, right? So how can we turn that around and reward people who are doing well and make sure that that happens? Again, you got to move, touch, and inspire your folks so they'll want to play by the rules. But you got to tell them what the rules are, and I think that's one of the biggest problems. People are really confused about what's expected of them. And I'll be glad to do whatever I can to help you. I mean, I'm a citizen. I would love to help you guys. I really would. I won't, just tell me what you need, and let's talk about it. I won't charge you. I would just, we'll play. I'd like...